This is On Behalf of the United States, how the nation's best advocates learned their skills. Listen to interviews with some of the DOJ's greatest lawyers on their thoughts about oral and written advocacy and what they've learned over their years of trying cases or handling appeals. On Behalf of the United States, with your host, Office of Legal Education Attorney Advisor, Kelly Zusman.
Welcome to the podcast, and I'm very pleased this week to introduce you to Peter Coates. Peter celebrates his 25th anniversary with the DOJ this year. He started out as an AUSA in the District of Nevada. He was there until 2003 when he joined the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Diego, where he has been ever since. Peter has been the criminal division chief, the appellate chief, the SLC. He was also chief of the National Security and Cyber Section. So he is a jack of all trades when it comes to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Peter, welcome.
And master of none. Thank you very much.
So, Peter, I want to first start by talking about what you described to me earlier as your evolution as a trial lawyer. So starting out maybe a little bit scripted, and then how did you change, and what does a Peter Cohen trial look like today?
You'd have to ask the others that. I think probably like a lot of attorneys, when I started out, if I was giving an opening or a closing, I tended to write everything out, and I tried to deliver that. And, you know, I tried to hew as closely as possible to whatever I had planned. And it's just how I felt comfortable. I felt prepared in the moment. But after watching a lot of trials and a lot of, not even trials, other presentations, trainings, things of that nature, I came around to the belief that the people who tended to be most effective are those who are not speaking at the audience, but they're speaking to the audience and they're trying to make a connection with the audience. And you don't do that by just reciting something to them. You do it by talking to them. And sometimes that has imperfections, but that's part of it. And, you know, you need to give yourself that leeway to make that connection with your audience. So I've worked at that ever since. I still plan things to a large degree when I, you know, do an opening or a closing. I'll probably write out most of it, if not all of it. But I'm a lot more comfortable deviating from whatever I planned before in terms of, you know, if I forget something, if I miss a point, well, then just move on. It's not the, you know, worst thing in the world, but it's more important that I'm trying to connect with the jury, trying to connect with the audience so that they're actually hearing what I have to say as opposed to just these words passing by their ears.
And Peter, you talked earlier about moving from a script to bullet points. So when you stand up to deliver an opening statement or a closing argument, is it the bullet points that you have sort of in hand or somewhere nearby?
No, I don't even actually. Nowadays, I try to do things from memory. So I will, you know, just get up and talk. And, you know, I've obviously written things out beforehand, but I don't bring those up with me, or I try not to. I might have a PowerPoint. And those would be my bullet points or my outline of things that just sort of prompts for me to remember this is what I, you know, this is where I'm going with this or what I'm going to talk about. And don't get me wrong, it's still very planned. I still have, you know, down to the occasional bad joke, but it's just more comfort in terms of not trying to deliver it as smoothly and as polished as, you know, I might have done earlier in my career.
Because you want that connection, you want the jurors,
right?
You know, or eye contact. You want them engaged, and you're working on that as opposed to your memorization skills.
Right. You can have the greatest written closing ever, but if the jury's not listening to you after 5 minutes because you're just talking at them, then it doesn't do any good. So I think it's more important that you're actually trying to get them to listen to you. And you do that by trying to connect with them, you know, whether it's the eye contact or pausing or sliding in a comment or two that just seems off the cuff, whatever. It's just something to keep them listening to you so they hear what you have to say.
As another early part of your career, you've described having a really tremendous mentor from the District of Nevada, and that was Tom O'Connell. And can you tell us about Tom and what you learned from him?
Yeah, Tom was my first supervisor, really my only supervisor when I was in Nevada. And he's not your typical federal prosecutor. He, you know, didn't go to a top 10 law school. He didn't work at a big law firm. He was a New York cop before he became a DA, and then he became a federal prosecutor. And he very much had a cop's mentality in terms of how he would go about investigating things, you know, in terms of gathering evidence. And what I, you know, I saw a number of his cases that he put together, oftentimes big cases, and, you know, a multitude of different forms of evidence. You know, you'd have cooperators, you'd have recordings, you'd have phone tolls, everything, whatever, the whole nine yards, but you'd have to mesh it all together. And the big takeaway I took from him is that, you know, we win our cases or we lose them before we ever charge them. You know, it's how you put your investigation together. And are you exploiting every possible opportunity to gather evidence? Are you being as creative as possible in that way? Are you thinking about, you know, when you're gathering your evidence, are you thinking about how am I going to present this in court? You know, it's one thing to have a cooperator, but these days, you have to corroborate your cooperators. So how are you going to corroborate them in the most powerful way possible? You know, what records are you going to go look for or find? And you know, when do you know that you have that one piece or, you know, probably more than one piece, two, three, four pieces that you can point to in front of a jury and say, this is how you know this guy's telling the truth. So, you know, that was very influential for me in terms of how I go about investigating cases. Just watching, you know, somebody who had the mentality more of a police officer investigating something as opposed to a lawyer.
Well, and that's really the best of both worlds, isn't it? Where you want someone with that sort of global perspective, if you will, about this is what it means on the investigation side, but then translating it into this is what it means for court. And Peter, you mentioned this notion of you know, how important it is to corroborate our cooperators. But today we're doing a lot more than that, aren't we? I mean, we got to corroborate everybody.
No, absolutely. I mean, when I first started, it used to be that was, you know, informants. Everybody's seen Judge Trott's outline, you know, about the evils of informants and you have to corroborate them. But now it's everybody. You know, it's a civilian witness, it's police officers, it's agents. You know, you can't just put a witness up on the stand anymore in this day and age, this mentality, and just say, they told it to you, you can believe them. It just doesn't work. So if you want to have success, you have to be looking to corroborate everybody through recordings, through different, you know, forms of evidence, documentary, whatever it might be, but you have to find that.
Well, and that's what a good prosecutor does is, you know, your agents may well be focused on probable cause. You know, so that's their driving force is we got to have probable cause because that gives us the arrest. And it's the lawyer who says, okay, but then how are we going to get from probable cause up to beyond reasonable doubt, which there's usually a huge gulf between those two points on our spectrum. And I think taking the time and making sure that your agents understand that principle, but also at the same time that you're being receptive to your agents' ideas about, hey, you know, we're in this together, and you know, we all want to see this prosecution succeed. Let me turn to opposing counsel. So a lot of us learn some really important lessons from an opposing counsel, and even if we don't want to admit to it, do you have a story you can tell us about something that you learned from an opposing lawyer?
Yes, and if Sherry Kaufman ever asks about it, I'll deny it. So I was a very new attorney, very new prosecutor. And we in Las Vegas, we had what was called the lake duty, which was you handled the cases from Lake Mead National Recreation Area. Very, very few of them went to trial. Most of them pled out because they were misdemeanors and infractions, that type of thing. But every now and again, you got one. And I remember doing I can't remember if it was a reckless or a DUI, but it was a bench trial in front of a magistrate. Sherry was the opposing counsel. She was a very experienced assistant federal public defender. And, you know, I put on my case, proved that, you know, called the ranger. He testified it happened in the Lake Mead National Recreation Area. I said, oh, okay, great, we rest. And she moved for, you know, judgment of acquittal and said the government hasn't proved that it happened within the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States. And I hadn't elicited that from a witness. I hadn't had somebody testify that the Lake Mead National Recreation Area is within the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States. So, you know, the judge looked at me cross-eyed for a couple minutes and asked me a couple questions. And I never got around to the point that he was trying to get to, which was like, you've already rested. You need to move to reopen. It was too inexperienced to figure that part out. And eventually he kind of just got fed up and he's like, you know, motion granted. And, you know, obviously that's a gut punch. Nobody likes to feel like they, you know, they're the reason you lost a case, even though I was the reason we lost the case. But what it taught me was, you know, the level of preparation and precision that I needed to have to be successful in this job. And it changed how I went about preparing cases. Everybody does a trial outline, or most people do a trial outline, but my trial outlines are probably different from most people's in that, you know, I will create basically, it's not a spreadsheet, but it's, you know, it's columns and boxes. I have times and dates. I have the fact I want to elicit. I have the witness who I can get it from, or witnesses. I have the exhibits I'm going to admit, you know, all of that is in there so that I know exactly what I'm going to prove and how I'm going to prove it and how I'm going to admit it. I'm thought ahead of time, you know, if I'm going to have some type of evidentiary objection to whatever it is and what my response is going to be, all of that. And then, you know, go back and match it up with the elements to make sure that I've nailed down if I have to prove it's in the special maritime and territorial jurisdiction of the United States, I actually have a witness who's going to say that and is competent to say that. So that was a lesson I learned. She taught it to me. She doesn't know she taught it to me, and I'll deny that she ever taught it to me if she ever asked. So
I think for most of us, we remember our mistakes much more keenly than we remember our successes. So let's turn to some lessons that you may have learned from some mistakes. And how about closing arguments? Can you tell us about that?
I got a lot of lessons. Yeah, I mean, the very first solo trial I ever did as a federal prosecutor, which would be the very first solo trial I ever did, period, I committed prosecutorial misconduct in closing. It was in rebuttal, and it was a felon in possession case. 20 plus years later, I still remember the defendant's name, James Earl Matthews. The defense had, you know, typical argument about, you know, why didn't the government call so-and-so who was there and could testify to these facts. And I was just too inexperienced at the time to know how to properly handle it. So I got up and, you know, doing the old thing we probably have all done at some point during rebuttal where you hear the defense say something and you make a note of it and you're like, okay, I'm going to say something in response to that. And you've got this sort of tick list that, you know, you go through. No, that was on my tick list. So I got up and said, you know, why didn't we call Mr. So-and-so? I don't know. That's probably my fault. He probably would have said the same thing as the cooperating witness. And, you know, as soon as I said it, I knew I messed up. I mean, I told you this, that, you know, if you could find the recording of it, I'm confident there's a multi-second pause right after I said it where you could almost see my brain going, how do I get that back into my mouth? but you couldn't. So, you know, you barrel forward and, you know, now it's memorialized in a published opinion for the Ninth Circuit, how I screwed that up. But, you know, it wasn't the last time I did a bad rebuttal. I mean, I didn't learn then that, you know, the tick list doesn't work. But eventually I came around to figuring out a better way to do rebuttal. And it was, you have to plan your rebuttals. You have to plan them. You can plan 80, 90% of it ahead of time. And, you know, we all know what the defense is going to be, you know, the core of the defense. You know, we may not know all the window dressing on it, but we know the core of the defense, which is I didn't do it, or I didn't know, or that wasn't my intent, or, you know, I did it, but I have an excuse. It's one of those every time, right? So that is the point that you need to rebut. And then you just listen to the defense and they say a few things and you pull some strands from that, and you weave it into it as far as, you know, they say, and knock that down. But that is, to me, a much more effective rebuttal. And it took me a while. It took me screwing up a few of these before I finally got around to it.
So, Peter, let me ask a follow-up. So the defense gets up and they say 27 things that are crazy. And you just told us we're not supposed to knock down every single one of those things. So can you describe to us, how do you figure out how to attack that defense close that has challenged you and challenged your agent on 27 points? How do we think about that and how do we tackle it?
So to me, the first thing you have to do in the rebuttal is you have to strip away what the defense is arguing. You know, they may say, like I said, every defense has window dressing on it. You know, they say something happened at a McDonald's. They pulled up a photo in the McDonald's and say, see, it corroborates what their defendant is claiming. Doesn't corroborate anything, but there's a bunch of window dressing on it that you sort of have to sift through for the jury. So the first thing is, you know, you get to the heart of it. You say, this is what they're really saying. You know, and when you strip away everything, they're saying he didn't know or he didn't do it, whatever it might be. And then beforehand, you've marshaled your four or five strongest points saying, no, he did do it or he did know or he did have the intent. And you just hammer those quickly. You know, I call it my Jason Bourne rule. You know, if you watch the movies, if he gets in a fight with somebody and he dispatches them in like one or two punches and the guy's flat on the floor, you're like, well, Bourne is the badass. I don't know if I could say that on a family-friendly podcast, but, and the other guy was nothing. But you also see those fights where he gets into it with somebody else who it goes on for like 5 minutes. And by the end of it, you know, they're both exhausted and bloody and, you know, and you're like, oh my goodness, the other guy's also, you know, pretty bad. Well, you don't want the jury thinking the other guy is pretty bad too. I mean, that's bad for you if they think you just went to a draw with the defense. You want to knock down that defense as quickly as possible. So you want to be the first guy who knocks them out in one or two punches. And that to me is the way you do it. You find your four or five strongest points. You make them as hard and as punchy as you can. And you get out and you do it quickly. That to me is an effective rebuttal. And you weave in, you know, the defense always gives you something that you can knock down pretty easily or something absurd. I mean, I shouldn't say always, but almost always. And you know, you weave that into your rebuttal as well. It's, maybe that's the unplanned portion of it. But to me, that's the most effective type of rebuttal. And I remember, I've told you the story that, you know, I the light bulb for me came on watching a friend of mine give a rebuttal in a high-profile corruption case. And it's famous in our office because at least people who are old enough to have been there, everybody remembers him getting up on the witness stand with a children's book and basically mocking the defense argument. But the part I remembered is that he had actually planned the entire rebuttal. He had in his head exactly what he was going to say. As soon as the defense, you know, finished closing, he shot out of his chair. I don't even think the judge turned to him and said, Mr. Forge. He just, boom, he was up there. He was firing away. And it was a very quick, very pointed, very punchy, direct, hard-hitting rebuttal, and then he was out, and it was very effective. And that, to me, was the light bulb moment, like, oh, you can plan a rebuttal, and you should plan a rebuttal, because you'll be a lot more effective, and you'll probably avoid a lot more problems.
Peter, that's great advice. So if I can, tell me if I'm accurately summarizing. So with rebuttal, A, you got to plan it and anticipate what the defense is going to be, because you probably have a good sense for that, a better sense than maybe you think you do. And then B, you got to be Jason Bourne against the bad guy with no name in the credits, right?
Exactly.
So not the star bad guy, but one
right.
of the sidekick bad guys.
Not the other assassin who's going to chase him all over the world and everybody's scared of him. That's not the guy you want to be fighting. You want to fight the guy, you know, the anonymous actor who just got knocked out in two punches.
Gotcha. Okay. Now, that's a great analogy. I think that's a great way of thinking about it, is that this is one of the sidecars, not like the big star playing the bad guy. So, Peter, let's to wrap this up today, what's your advice to lawyers who may be thinking, you know, I've been doing this for a while, Peter, I've been here 10, 15 years. What's the one thing that you think that lawyers who've been doing this for a while could do better, particularly in the courtroom?
I would say, you know, when you have some self-awareness, I think is of how you're affecting people, you know, and that when you've done this for a while, you tend to get comfortable and you also tend to get maybe a little, I don't know if immune is the word, to how you're not as conscious of basically how you're affecting others or how you're coming across to others. You're a little too comfortable. And I think we always have to remember that, you know, the way we comport ourselves, it affects how others perceive us. You know, if it affects how the jury perceives us, it affects how the judge, the defense bar. You have to remember those things. And, you know, that if you're acting like a jerk, if you're always acting contentious, if you, whatever it might be, then they're going to respond in that way to you. And, you know, the flip side of that is if you're always professional with them, if you're not always fighting on everything, you only fight on the things that matter, they realize that and they respond in the same way back to you. You know, and the jury perceives it. You know, they have nothing better to look at. They're just watching. If you're always fighting with opposing counsel and you guys are sniping back and forth, you're hurting your credibility. You know, you're not coming across as the cool, level-headed professional you should be. So I think I have to remind myself, I think everybody needs to remind themselves, you know, you need to be self-aware. You need to understand the way things, the way you comport yourself, how that is affecting your ability to do your job.
Well, and I think that's excellent advice for both inside and outside the courtroom. So, of course, inside the courtroom, jurors watch everything, and so does the judge. I mean, it's like they've got, 360-degree eyeballs up there. They know when our agent is smirking or, you know, is behaving inappropriately. And the jury, too. I clerked a trial as a law clerk where one of the jurors actually drew. She was an artist, and she drew everybody in the courtroom. So, you know, paying attention to little details like, you know, who parted their hair which way and who wore certain clothing. And then, of course, in our offices, I think, you know, having an attitude of, as you mentioned, professionalism, but also just being in a good mood. I think it lifts everyone. You become more approachable if you are engaged and enthusiastic and upbeat. And people tend to avoid the grumpies, right?
I don't know. I'm probably in the grumpy category, or at least perceived to be. But no, you're absolutely right. I mean, it affects when you're working in a team, for example, like a prosecution team, and you have, you know, your paralegals, your legal assistant, your agents, co-counsel, whatever it might be. You know, the way you comport yourself is going to trickle down to how they comport themselves. If you're always the one who's fighting about something and fighting with defense counsel, well, then more likely that's how the attitude they're going to have. So, yeah, we always have to watch and be aware of how we're affecting others and you know, ultimately how that's, for one thing, it just makes you happier if you're not always fighting with people, but also how that's affecting your ability to effectively do your job. You know, you might be shooting yourself in the foot in ways that you don't even realize. And like you said, you know, especially in court, the judge, the jury, they've got nothing else to look at. I mean, they're staring at you. I mean, what else are they going to look? They can't watch TV. They can't pull out their phones. So they're watching, you know, how is that guy conducting himself? Is his table a mess? Is his shoes a mess? Whatever. And they're judging you for it as much as, you know, probably they shouldn't be, but they are. So you have to be aware of those things and always keep that in mind.
Terrific. Well, Peter, thank you very much. You've had some great thoughts and some great advice for our listeners today, and we very much appreciate your time.
Thank you for having me so much.
Thanks for listening to On Behalf of the United States. Tune in next time for another episode with the Department of Justice's greatest lawyers. Thanks for listening.